Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Pollution is Colonialism by Max Liberon, narrated by Donna Postel. Publisher's note: this audiobook contains references to visuals present in the print and ebook editions of the book. Introduction. In 1956, Lloyd Stouffer, the editor of the U.S. magazine Modern Packaging, addressed attendees at the Society of the Plastics Industry meeting in New York City. "The future of plastics is in the trash can. It is time for the plastics industry to stop thinking about reuse packages and concentrate on single use. For the package that is used once and thrown away, like a tin can or a paper carton, represents not a one-shot market for a few thousand units, but an everyday recurring market measured by the billions of units." Stouffer was speaking at a time when reuse, making do, and thrift were key practices reinforced by two U.S. wars. Consumer markets were saturating. Disposability was one tactic within a suite of efforts to move goods through, rather than merely into, consumer households. Today, packaging is the single largest category of plastic production, accounting for nearly 40% of plastic production in Europe and 33% in Canada. The next largest categories are building and construction, at just over 20%, and automotive, at 8%. Stouffer's desire looks like a prophecy. Spoiler, it isn't. It's colonialism. But more on that in a moment. Before Stouffer's call for disposability, and before German and U.S. military powers invested significant finances and research infrastructure into perfecting plastics as a wartime material in the 1940s, plastic was described as an environmental good, mimicking first ivory and then other animal-based materials, such as shellac and tortoise shell. Plastic was an artisan substance that showcased technological ingenuity and skill while providing the elephant, the tortoise, and the coral insect a respite in their native haunts. It will no longer be necessary to ransack the earth in pursuit of substances which are constantly growing scarcer. The idea of disposability and mass production for plastics is relatively new, developing half a century after plastics were invented. Most plastic production graphs start their timelines after 1950, ignoring the 19th and early 20th century histories of plastics, since these materials did not exist as the mass-produced substances we know today. Plastics have been otherwise. In 1960, only 4 years after Stouffer's address, a British ornithology journal published an account of the confounding discovery of a rubber band in a puffin's stomach. It would be among the first of hundreds of published reports of wildlife ingesting plastics, including the ones I publish as an environmental scientist. How did plastics become such a ubiquitous pollutant? There are questions that should precede that question. What do you mean by pollutant? How did pollutants come to make sense in the first place? It turns out that the concept of environmental pollution, as we understand it today, is also new. Only 20 years before Stouffer launched the future of plastics into the trash can, the now dominant and even standard understanding of modern environmental pollution was articulated on the Ohio River. Two engineers in the brand new field of sanitation engineering, named Earl B. Phelps and H.W. Streeter, both unmarked, created a scientific and mathematical model of the conditions and rates under which water, or at least that bit of the Ohio River, could purify itself of organic pollutants. After running tests that accounted for different temperatures, velocities of water, concentrations of pollutants, and other variables, they wrote that self-purification is a measurable phenomenon governed by definite laws and proceeding according to certain fundamental physical and biochemical reactions. Because of the fundamental character of these reactions and laws, it is fairly evident that the principles underlying the phenomenon of self-purification as a whole are applicable to virtually all polluted streams. The Streeter-Phelps equation, as it came to be known, not only became a hallmark of water pollution science and regulation, but also contained within it their theory of pollution, that a moment existed when water could not purify itself, and that moment could be measured, predicted, and properly called pollution. Self-purification became known as assimilative capacity, a term of art in both environmental science and policy making that refers to the amount of waste material that may be discharged into a receiving water without causing deleterious ecological effects. State-based environmental regulations in most of the world since the 1930s are premised on the logic of assimilative capacity, in which a body, water, human, or otherwise, can handle a certain amount of contaminant before scientifically detectable harm occurs. I call this the threshold theory of pollution. Plastics do not assimilate in the way that Streeter and Phelps's organic pollution assimilated in the Ohio River. As I pull little pieces of burned plastic out of a dovekie gizzard in my marine science lab, the Civic Laboratory for Environmental Action Research, CLEAR, the threshold theory of pollution and the future of plastics as waste look like bad relations. I don't mean the individualized bad relations of littering, which does not produce much waste compared to other flows of plastic into the ocean, especially here in Newfoundland and Labrador, a land of fishing gear and untreated sewage, or the bad relations of capitalism, where growth and profit are put before environmental costs, though those are certainly horrible relations. I mean the bad relations of a scientific theory that allows some amount of pollution to occur, and its accompanying entitlement to land to assimilate that pollution. I mean colonialism. The structures that allow plastic's global distribution and full integration into ecosystems and everyday human lives are based on colonial land relations, the assumed access by settler and colonial projects to indigenous lands for settler and colonial goals. At the same time, the ways in which plastics pollute unevenly do not follow threshold theories of harm and act as both hosts for life and sources of harm have made plastics an ideal case to change dominant colonial concepts of pollution by teaching us about relations and obligations that tend to be obfuscated from view by environmental rhetoric and industrial infrastructures. In CLEAR, we place land relations at the center of our knowledge production as we monitor plastic pollution in the province of Newfoundland and Labrador. As members of a marine science lab, we are dedicated to doing science differently by foregrounding anti-colonial land relations. This requires critique, but mostly it requires action. We've stopped using toxic chemicals to process samples, which means there's a whole realm of analysis we can't do. We also use judgmental sampling rather than random sampling in our study design to foreground food sovereignty when we look at plastics in food webs. CLEAR does good with pollution, in practice, in place. But CLEAR is not unique. Land relations always already play a central role in all sciences, anti-colonial and otherwise. I find that many people understand colonialism as a monolithic structure with roots exclusively in historical bad action, rather than as a set of contemporary and evolving land relations that can be maintained by good intentions and even good deeds. The call for more recycling, for example, still assumes access to indigenous land for recycling centers and their pollution. Other people have nuanced understandings of colonialism, and seek ways to deal with colonial structures in their everyday lives and research, often in spaces like the academy that reproduce colonialism in uneven ways. This book is for both groups, and others besides. Overall, this is a methodological text that begins with colonial land relations, so that we can recognize them in familiar and comfortable places, like reading, like counting, and then considers anti-colonial methods that center and change colonial land relations in thought and action. I make three main arguments in this book. First, pollution is not a manifestation or side effect of colonialism, but is rather an enactment of ongoing colonial relations to land. That is, pollution is best understood as the violence of colonial land relations rather than environmental damage, which is a symptom of violence. These colonial relations are reproduced through even well-intentioned environmental science and activism. Second, there are ways to do pollution action, particularly environmental science, through different land relations, and they're already happening without waiting for the decolonial horizon to appear. These methods are specific, place-based, and attend to obligations. Third, I show how methodologies, whether scientific, writerly, readerly, or otherwise, are always, already, part of land relations, and thus are a key site in which to enact good relations, sometimes called ethics. This last point should carry to a variety of contexts that do not focus on either pollution or the natural sciences. I use the case of plastics, increasingly understood as an environmental scourge and something to be annihilated, to refute and refuse the colonial in a good way. That is, I try to keep plastics and pollution from being conflated too readily, instead decoupling them so existing and potential relations can come to light that exceed the popular position of plastics are bad, even though plastics are often bad. To start, let's dig into colonialism. Spoiler, it is not synonymous with bad in general, though it is certainly bad. Colonialism. Stouffer, Streeter, and Phelps all assumed access to indigenous land when they made their proclamations. Stouffer's declaration about the future of plastics as disposables assumed that household waste would be picked up and taken to landfills or recycling plants that allowed plastic disposables to go away. Without this infrastructural access to indigenous land, there is no disposability. He assumed that land would provide a sink, a place to store waste, so that profits could be generated through flows of waste as consumer goods. This assumption is made easier when the land has already been cleared of indigenous peoples via genocide, moves to reserves, and ongoing disappearances, such as those catalogued under MMIWG statistics. Streeter and Phelps likewise assumed access to indigenous land, though they were not capitalists dedicated to growth and profit. On the contrary, Phelps was a bold environmental conservationist. Unlike his contemporaries, he believed polluted rivers could and should be saved from, rather than abandoned to, industrial pollution, by using science to keep the pollution below a threshold from which the rivers could recover. But his theory of self-purification come assimilative capacity also assumed access to indigenous land. Phelps not only accessed indigenous land along the Ohio River to do his science, he also routinized state access by advocating for all rivers, on all lands, to be governed, carefully, precisely, as proper sinks for pollution. Whether motivated by profit and growth or environmental conservation, both approaches to waste and wasting are premised on an assumed entitlement to indigenous land. That's colonialism. While there are different types of colonialism, settler colonialism, extractive colonialism, internal colonialism, external colonialism, neo-imperialism, they have some things in common. Colonialism is a way to describe relationships characterized by conquest and genocide that grant colonialists and settlers ongoing state access to land and resources that contradictorily provide the material and spiritual sustenance of indigenous societies on the one hand, and the foundation of colonial state formation, settlement, and capitalist development on the other. Colonialism is more than the intent, identities, heritages, and values of settlers and their ancestors. It's about genocide and access. Emphasizing the role of access to indigenous land for colonialism, Edward Said, Palestinian, writes, "To think about distant places, to colonize them, to populate or depopulate them, all of this occurs on, about, or because of land. The actual geographical possession of land is what empire, in the final analysis, is all about. At the moment when a coincidence occurs between real control and power, the idea of what a given place was, could be, might become, and an actual place, at that moment, the struggle for empire is launched. This coincidence is the logic both for Westerners taking possession of land and during decolonization for resisting natives reclaiming it." Let's take a moment to focus on that bit about Westerners. Western culture, the heritage of social norms, beliefs, ethical values, political systems, epistemologies, technologies, and legal structures and traditions heavily influenced by various forms of Christianity and Judaism that have some origin in ancient Greece and which heavily influenced societies in Europe and beyond, is not synonymous with colonialism. Western culture certainly has its imperialistic and colonial impulses, histories, and ideas of what is good and right, but these are different things from colonialism. When I hear a researcher ask, "Isn't doing research ethics paperwork colonial?" they are conflating Western and colonial. Remember, treaties are paperwork. If paperwork is used to possess land and secure settler and colonial futures, then yes, it's colonial. But there is also anti-colonial Western-style paperwork that accomplishes the opposite, like the forms required by indigenous research ethics boards. Colonialism, first, foremost, and always, is about land, including the circumvention of ethics paperwork so researchers can have unfettered and unaccountable access to field sites, aka homelands, archives, samples, and data. The focus on land, what it could be, what it might become, what it is for, does not always mean accessing land as property for settlement, though it often does. It can also mean access to land-based cultural designs and culturally appropriated symbols for fashion. It can mean access to indigenous land for scientific research. It can mean using land as a resource, a practice that may generate pollution through pipelines, landfills, and recycling plants, or as a sink to store or process waste. It can mean imagining a clean, healthy, and pollution-free future, and conducting beach cleanups on indigenous land without permission or consent. It means imagining things for land in ways that align with colonial and settler goals, even when those goals are well-intentioned, especially when they are well-intentioned, which means it's time to talk about environmentalism. Environmentalism and colonialism. Environmentalism does not usually address colonialism and often reproduces it. Philosopher Kyle White, Potawatomi, Dina Julia Whitaker, Colville Confederated Tribes, and many others have pointed out that environmental solutions to pollution, such as hydroelectric dams, consumer responsibility, and appeals to the commons, assumes access to indigenous land and its ability to produce value for settler and colonial desires and futures. Environmentalism often propagates and maintains the dispossession of indigenous peoples for the common good of the world. For example, in September 2015, a U.S.-based environmental NGO called the Ocean Conservancy released a report looking for solutions to marine plastic pollution that recommended that countries in Southeast Asia work with foreign-funded industries to build incinerators to burn plastic waste. This recommendation follows a long line of colonial acts in the name of plastics, from accessing indigenous land to extracting oil and gas, and occasionally corn for feedstock, to producing disposable plastics that use land to store, contain, and assimilate the waste, to pointing the finger at local, foreign, and indigenous peoples for mismanaging waste imported from industrial and colonial centers, and then gaining access to that land to solve their uncivilized approach to waste mismanagement. This is not to say that the Ocean Conservancy is evil, or even aware of its colonial mindset. Colonialism doesn't come from asshat goons, though it certainly has a large share of such agents. Colonial land relations are inherited as common sense, even as good ideas. Many environmental historians have shifted their understanding of the origins of environmentalism well before Back to the Land and Save the Access to Land movements of the 1960s and 1970s. Instead, they highlight earlier imperial archiving, cultivation, and control measures necessary for the flourishing of empire around the globe, both within and outside of what is lately called North America. They argue that the colonial scientists who attempted to mitigate and halt environmental destruction in colonies so that the colonies might flourish are the pioneers of modern environmentalism, where environmentalism is police action, inseparable from Western conceptions and attitudes of how to best organize and govern land. More on this in Chapter 1. The way that environmental crises and their solutions maintain rather than change existing power structures is central to the scholarship of anthropologist Joseph Masco, settler, who points out that crisis, environmental and otherwise, has become a counter-revolutionary idiom in the 21st century, a means of stabilizing an existing condition, rather than minimizing forms of violence across militarisms, economy, and the environment. Rather than using crisis as a relational model that puts certain things beyond dispute in the imperative to act at all costs, I focus on colonial land relations within environmental narratives and action as a way to acknowledge and address this usually unmarked power dynamic. Capitalism and colonialism. To change colonial land relations and enact other types of land relations requires specificity. This is so we don't accidentally think that the opposite of colonialism is environmentalism, or similarly, that we don't conflate colonialism with other forms of extraction, such as capitalism. Colonialism and capitalism might be happy bedfellows, and indeed longtime lovers, but they are not the same thing. Political economist Karl Marx, unmarked, argues that primitive accumulation, the stealing of land, is foundational to the possibility of capitalism. It's how someone gets more capital than someone else in the first place, which you need to jumpstart a system where only a few people own the means of production. You can't make and hoard capital without stealing land first. We have case studies of how aspects of capitalist production and technologies allow specific forms of colonialism and dispossession to take root and spread. Likewise, excellent research describes the sweet trifecta of capitalism, colonialism, and pollution. The treadmill of industrial and capitalist production is ever in need of more land to contain its pollution, leading to the argument that contamination and resource dispossession are necessary and inherent factors of capitalism. Yet colonial quests for land are different than capitalist goals for capital, even if pollution has a role in attaining each goal. Socioeconomic systems other than capitalism also create environmental pollution and waste. But what's more important for understanding the relationship between capitalism and colonialism is that many different economic systems depend on access to indigenous land. As Sandy Grande, Quechua, has argued, both Marxists and capitalists view land and natural resources as commodities to be exploited, in the first instance by capitalists for personal gain, and in the second by Marxists for the good of all. Eve Tuck, Unangak, and Wayne Yang, diaspora settler of color, have pointed out, socialist and communist empires have also been settler empires. For example, Chinese colonialism in Tibet. Colonialism is not one kind of thing, with one set of techniques that always align with capitalism. Marxism, socialism, anti-capitalism, capitalism, and other economic systems can, though certainly don't have to, enact colonial relations to land as a usable resource that produces value for settler and colonizer goals, regardless of how and by whom that value is produced. Colonialism, capitalism, and environmentalism do not have settled relationships or forms. For instance, colonialist states and powers have at times sided with environmental conservation over capitalist gains. Historians have documented how, as Richard Grove, Unmarked, puts it, paradoxically, the colonial state, in its pioneering conservationist role, provided a forum for controls on the unhindered operations of capital for short-term gain, which, it might be argued, brought about a contradiction to what is normally supposed to have made up the common currency of imperial expansion. Ultimately, the long-term security of the state, which any ecological crisis threatened to undermine, counted for far more than the interests of private capital bent on the destruction of the environment. To make capitalism and colonialism synonymous, or to conflate environmentalism and anti-colonialism, misses these complex relations. Because of this nuance and its repercussions for political action, political scientist Glenn Coulthard, Yellowknives Dene, has called for scholars to shift their analysis away from capitalist relations, production, proletarianization, to colonial relations, dispossession, land acquisition, access to land. Like capital, colonialism, as a structure of domination predicated on dispossession, is not a thing, but rather the sum effect of the diversity of interlocking oppressive social relations that constitute it. When stated this way, it should be clear that shifting our position to highlight the ongoing effects of colonial dispossession in no way displaces questions of distributive justice or class struggle. Rather, it simply situates these questions more firmly alongside and in relation to the other sites and relations of power that inform our settler-colonial present. Conflating colonialism with capitalism misses crucial relations, which Coulthard argues include white supremacy and patriarchy. Eileen Morton Robinson, Gorinpul, Kwandamuka First Nation, has shown that it misses racial formations and racism. For thinkers such as Tuck and Yang, the homogenization of various experiences of oppression as colonialism, that is, conflating imperialism, racism, capitalism, exclusion, and general bad behavior with colonialism, accomplishes a form of enclosure, dangerous in how it domesticates decolonization. It is also a foreclosure, limiting in how it recapitulates dominant theories of social change. Differentiation and specificity matter to ensure that actions address problems, and the conflation of colonialism with other ills, ensures the erasure of horizons of meaningful action that can attend specifically to assumed settler and colonial entitlement and access.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?